Despite his appearance on the $10 bill, Alexander Hamilton has not fared well among historians of the early republic or among the biographers of the founding fathers, at least until recently. Born out of wedlock, yet commonly portrayed as having aristocratic intentions, often at the center of political firestorms that brought him into conflict with more popular figures like Thomas Jefferson, involved in one of the nation's first political sex scandals and killed in a duel by a political rival, Hamilton's life has all the markings of high drama, all of which has been brought to life by his latest and some would argue his best biographer to date, Ron Chernow. Chernow's biography has attracted widespread attention and gathered numerous awards over the past several months, including being named by the New York Times as one of the 10 best books of the year. Welcome, Ron.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you, Ryan.
In your biography, you fundamentally changed the longstanding view of Alexander Hamilton that I briefly alluded to in my introduction. Through your words, he becomes the architect of a modern America in both its politics and economics, creating the building blocks of the nation's government and economy. I want to give you a chance to make this case, but first, get us started by telling us about his birth and childhood.
Well, Hamilton had this ghastly Dickensian childhood. He was an illegitimate young man from the Caribbean. When he's 11, his father abandons the family. His mother dies of island fever when Alexander is 13. He's farmed out to a first cousin who commits suicide a year later. So 15, 16, 17, Alexander Hamilton is an impoverished orphan clerk toiling away at a trading house in the Caribbean. This seems to be the least auspicious beginning for a great life imaginable.
Certainly different than most of the founding fathers.
Yeah, he's the only founding father who grows up outside of the North American colonies.
Okay, but somehow he makes it to the colonies. He arrives in New York in 1773 on the eve of the American Revolution, and he even enters college. He enrolls at King's College, which is now Columbia. How did that all come about?
Well, the local merchants on St. Croix, where he spent his adolescence, took up a subscription fund to educate him in North America. And when he was an undergraduate at King's, later Columbia, he's already as an undergraduate student extraordinaire. He's publishing stirring pamphlets against the British. He's making electrifying speeches to large crowds, and he takes up a musket, and he's drilling with fellow students at a nearby churchyard. He didn't graduate because the American Revolution intervenes, and Hamilton becomes captain of an artillery company, and it's as the captain of that artillery company that he comes to the attention of many powerful generals, including General George Washington himself. And by March 1777, the kid who had been toiling away as an obscure clerk on St. Croix is appointed aide-de-camp to General George Washington. A miraculous transformation.
And that's really a key relationship for him. I guess one could argue that if he hadn't made that contact, we don't know where he would have gone with his political
life.
It's
the most unbeatable combination because Hamilton was always opinionated and always controversial, and Washington is a kind of political untouchable who gives him political power and political cover. They're perfectly complementary figures to the extent that Washington is a figure of great integrity, patriotism, courage, and most important of all, great judgment. If Washington is the greatest politician of the early Republic, Hamilton, I think, was the greatest policymaker. So each had something that the other didn't.
Even before the war ends, he's getting involved in politics, mm-hmm. often behind the scenes rather than been out in front. But already you can see him heading in that direction. What do you think brought him into this, and how did he first get involved in politics?
Well, like Washington and like many other officers in the Continental Army, Hamilton was very frustrated by the weakness of the Continental Congress. He felt that we paid a terrible price for the fact that the Continental Congress could only request but not demand money and troops. And so already during the Revolution, he's beginning to fashion a vision of a powerful nation state with a strong federal government. It's Hamilton, actually, who issues the appeal for the Constitutional Convention. He attends it. He's the sole New York delegate to sign it. But even more important than his role at the convention is his role afterwards. Each state had individually ratified. There was particular hostility to the Constitution in New York. Hamilton, at the New York State ratifying convention, he speaks 26 times in 6 weeks, manages to eke out a narrow victory for the Constitution in New York. Most important of all, he dreams up and supervises and writes more than two-thirds of the Federalist Papers, the most persuasive defense of the Constitution ever written. At last count, had been cited by the Supreme Court nearly 300 times, more than any document in American history.
You clearly correct about his role in the Federalist Papers, an important document. He wrote most of them. What was his voice during the Constitutional Convention itself?
Well, during the Constitutional Convention, he's in a strange position because on the one hand, he's involved in activities ranging from being on the committee that sets the rules at the beginning to being a member of the committee at the end that actually gives the finish to the prose of the Constitution. So in general ways, he's out of sympathy with the Constitution. He makes one six-hour speech where he argues for a president who is elected but then who will serve for life, that Hamilton goes throughout his life trying to balance this desire for liberty with a fear of disorder and trying to make the government at the same time responsive to the electorate but also insulated from political opinion. And this, of course, forms a great divide between him and, let's say, Jefferson. Jefferson has great faith in the wisdom of the common man. Hamilton, who grew up on a slave island in the Caribbean, most certainly did not have that kind of almost instinctive faith in the wisdom of the common people. And I think from the balance of those two figures, we got a very nice system.
Right. Interesting. Here's a guy who goes to the Constitutional Convention to promote an even stronger document than we end up getting. But nevertheless, he settles for it and goes out and becomes a leader, really, in getting it ratified by the states.
Yeah, Hamilton thought that the Constitution, he loved the liberties expressed in the Constitution. He was just rather dubious that it would work. He thought that maybe it was utopian or quixotic in some way. So he said that he would do everything in his power to see that the Constitution actually flourished, even though he had disagreed with elements of it. Like a great lawyer, he was able to write a very, very persuasive brief for it. But I think it's important to point out that he was absolutely true to his pledge to do everything to make the Constitution work. And also, I think, important to point out that all of the founders, all of the delegates of the Constitutional Convention had ideas other than those finally incorporated into the document. It was a compromise.
But at this point, he's really teamed up pretty well with most of the people we would identify today as being the founding fathers. He's of one mind with Jefferson and Madison and Washington in terms of wanting the Constitution to be ratified.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, he's actually a much, much stronger advocate of the Constitution than Jefferson, who really is very, very equivocal at first because this central government looks much too powerful for Jefferson's tastes.
So it's not surprising that he becomes part of, and we mentioned this when we were talking earlier, of what I consider to be the dream team when people think of Washington being President Adams, the Vice President, Jefferson, Secretary of State, Hamilton, Secretary of the Treasury. But the dream team doesn't work very well together.
No. In fact, there is a central split. There are three people in the cabinet. They didn't use the term, but Jefferson is Secretary of State and Hamilton is Secretary of the Treasury are constantly feuding. The battle becomes so bitter that Washington finally has to intervene and plead them to stop. The battle is partly personalities. Jefferson is very shy, very courtly. Hamilton is very much the strutting peacock, you know, very opinionated, loves debate. But there's a fundamental ideological divide that opens between them that is so deep that it actually spawns the two-party system. Hamilton wants a strong central government headed by a vigorous president. Hamilton foresees a society that will be shaped not only by agriculture, but manufacturing, stock exchanges, banks, corporations. And Hamilton also favors a very expansive interpretation of the Constitution. In the case of Jefferson, wants an agricultural paradise, favors states' rights, wants a weak central government, and favors a very, very strict construction of the Constitution. And so that this ideological divide is so deep that I'm not sure we've ever bridged the chasm to this day.
Right, exactly. And this is sort of the general, or as you put it, the ideological chasm between them. But it plays itself out in some very specific issues that they're facing during the first administration. We don't have time to go through all of them, but let's take a couple of them. The nation's finances, for example.
Yeah, Hamilton, we had financed the American Revolution with a tremendous amount of debt. So Hamilton, as Treasury Secretary, took over a country that was bankrupt. We hadn't paid principal or interest on the debt for many years. Hamilton felt that as a matter of national honor and also national strength that we should pay off the debt. The way that he did it created some of the most bitter battles in the early republic. For instance, a lot of Revolutionary War veterans had been given IOUs that were worthless at the time. They sold them for 15, 20 cents on the dollar. Hamilton wanted them paid off at par, that is a dollar on the dollar. And a lot of speculators scooped them up and made a killing. Jefferson and Madison wanted the government to go back to the poor folks who had sold the debt 10 years earlier. Hamilton said, number one, that's unworkable. Two, you can't have functioning capital markets unless people who buy a security know that they're entitled to all the profit and loss from those securities. So these are very, very fundamental battles. And it was very, very difficult to be seeming to punish Revolutionary War veterans who had sold that debt for low price years before.
Okay, what about the National Bank?
National Bank, very, very important. There was nothing in the Constitution about having a central bank, and so Jefferson and Madison, the strict constructionists, oppose it. Hamilton said that the powers to create a central bank were implied in the Constitution. This is a doctrine that, in a way, breaks the straitjacket of the Constitution. Hamilton wanted a central bank because, in studying European countries, he realized that their financial power was the basis of their political and military power. He wanted a central bank in order to create capital. We were short of capital. There was no common national currency. He thought that it would give us a uniform national currency. It would give people a place to pay taxes. So it performed a very wide variety of economic functions in a country that didn't have a banking system.
Right. And of course, there are many other issues if we had time we could get to, including foreign affairs, which is another interesting point. But let's move Hamilton on in his life and talk a little about his affair with Maria Reynolds.
Summer of 1791, Hamilton is at the height of his powers. In fact, was so controversial, he should have been especially careful about what he did. But 23-year-old Maria Reynolds, who must have been very sexy, knocked on his door one night, spilled out this woeful tale of how she'd been abandoned by her husband, and asked Hamilton for financial aid. That night, Hamilton went with the money to her rooming house, and in a classic statement said that when he got there, she invited him into her bedroom and indicated that more than pecuniary consolation would be acceptable. He carried on this affair with Maria Reynolds for a year, even after Mr. Reynolds, several months into the affair, appeared, began to blackmail Hamilton, and Hamilton paid the blackmail. This is really extraordinarily self-destructive behavior, showing that the smartest people can do the most foolish things.
It was a setup?
Yes, they were confidence people, and there may even have been a political dimension to it. In fact, it got Hamilton in all sorts of trouble because the Jeffersonians, when they found out about the money paid to James Reynolds, they thought that that was because Hamilton and Reynolds were speculating in Treasury securities. Hamilton ended up publishing a 95-page pamphlet saying, oh, no, I was paying Mr. Reynolds money for adultery, not for speculation.
Okay. Hamilton does resign as Secretary of the Treasury in 1795, goes back to New York, but he's still involved in politics and gets involved, in fact, in the election of 1800 that really brings about his demise. Can you sort of briefly tell us about that?
1800 election, Thomas Jefferson runs for president. It was understood that he was on the same ticket with Aaron Burr, who was supposed to be the vice president on that ticket. Under the constitutional rules in force at the time, there was no separate vote for president and vice president, with the result that Jefferson and Burr, nominally on the same ticket, tie. The election is thrown into the House of Representatives. Hamilton's party, the Federalists, wanted to see Burr as president. Hamilton, whose archenemy was Jefferson, suddenly threw his weight on the side of Thomas Jefferson. Very unexpected. Why did he do that? He said that he would rather have Jefferson, who had the wrong principles, than Aaron Burr, who had no principles. Well, Burr, of course, knew about this. 1804, when he ran for re-election, Jefferson dropped Burr from the ticket. Burr went back to New York, ran for governor. Hamilton blocked him again. It was the fact that Hamilton had prevented him first from becoming president, then from becoming governor of New York, that really forms the political context for the duel in which Vice President Aaron Burr shoots and kills Alexander Hamilton July 11th, 1804.
Yeah. What a way to end a life, given the way he started and then everything he accomplished, then he ends up dying in a duel.
What a waste. You know, you see in Hamilton, he goes from strength to strength. And then it all falls apart tragically at the end.
Yeah. Well, it's a great story, and I wish we had more time to do it. I'm looking at it here. You have 750 pages of book, and it's a great read, and I'm hoping our listeners will pick it up and spend a lot more time with it than we have.
I hope so. Thanks so much, Ron.
Well, thank you very much. I've been speaking with Ron Chernow, the author of Alexander Hamilton, published by Penguin Books, and this is Talking History.